This is the SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. And today we have a very special podcast for our listeners, what I've come to call a superstar panel. I can't take credit for putting this one together. That was all my friend James. And James Gates is an author and an editor in her own right. And James, actually last night I was just talking with Jeff Vandermeer about Book Life Now. But anyway, I digress. Why don't you go ahead and tell people who you are and what you do?
I am an editor and author, not a Hugo winner, unfortunately, although, you know, I work for the awesome SF Signal sometimes, so close enough. I'm working currently on finalizing an anthology called War Stories that is military science fiction with a focus on the near future and the way the war is changing. And I'm also the communications director for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. And so at the same time that I was trying to finish War Stories, I was also trying to get the very unusually large SIFWA bulletin to the printer as well. So if I'm a little spacey tonight, I do apologize. I have no brain left.
So being PR for SIFWA, that's like a stress-free, that's like a cakewalk, right? I mean, there's nothing ever comes up there.
I really wish you could see my face right now. Because if there is a power to reach through the internet and fry someone, it's happening right now. So if you're starting to feel a little warm, there's a reason.
There's a reason that James and I have not been at the same convention in years. And that's because I don't know if she's going to hug me or stab me.
Given that that's a valid question, even when I'm not irritated with someone.
Oh, and before I start introducing the superstars, why don't you tell people what was your genesis for wanting to do this podcast?
So the issue of military science fiction and the way that the military and veterans are portrayed has actually been an interest of mine for some time. I have several family members who have been in war recently, one of whom writes for Ranger Up. I'm on the subject of veteran affairs and military affairs. And so it's kind of an audience that I've been around for a while. And it's just a question that I've seen a lot of popping up recently. But where this specifically came out of was a panel at Dragon Con last year that I kind of got added to last minute. And without naming the guilty, there were, I think, 6 military science fiction authors up there, and the question went around, if you haven't been in the military, where do you get your information? And these are not small authors. These are the powerhouses in the industry, and they start listing blogs and books, and, it's places like Ranger Up and the Duffel Blog. All of these are being listed. And I'm sitting there thinking I'm not going to have anything to add, because surely someone is going to mention the obvious. And we get down to me, I'm the last person on the panel, and no one has mentioned Ask a Soldier. And we have one of the largest living, active, recent veteran populations in the history of America. We're actually starting to discuss and have visibility for things like PTSD, the political problems of the military, all of these things that are very valid and very current and need to be talked about. And it seems like no one is really understanding how present that community is and how much that needs to be discussed and seen in modern military science fiction. So I recently interviewed the guys up at Ranger Up. I'll be running an article for SF Signal covering that. And then I'm doing this pair of podcasts. And we have War Stories coming out soon, which is also focused on those same issues. So,
and you mentioned pair of podcasts. We are going to do another one that's going to come here in a couple weeks. So I'm going to go down the list here and introduce people. And I want each of you to say who you are and what you do. And let's start off with Richard Dansky.
Hi, I'm Richard Dansky. I'm the Central Clancy writer for Ubisoft. Day job, I write video games. I've worked on titles including Splinter Cell Blacklist, several titles in the Ghost Recon Rainbow Six series, as well as others. I've also published 6 novels, most recently Vaporware with Journal Stone, and a short fiction collection called Snowbird Gothic through Nikon eBooks. And you can find me on Twitter at rdansky.
Did you have anything to do with the first PC Tom Clancy Ghost Recon game?
The first Ghost Recon game, my contribution to that title was I wrote the manual and I wrote the bios for the characters in the Ghost Squad. The two mission packs for that title, Desert Siege and Island Thunder, I was the lead designer and writer on those mission packs.
Yeah, I'm squeeing myself. That SWAT 4 and XCOM are probably my favorite squad based fireteam level games. So I'm really honored to meet you.
Yes,
cool. I'm glad you enjoy it.
Absolutely, because that is hands down to this day that is still my favorite of those Clancy games.
And the most realistic, I think anyone will tell you, in terms of dialing in on what the fireteam experience is like.
That actually got me back into PC gaming. Seriously. It blew me away, and I went out and got the other missions afterwards because it just blew me away. So that's awesome. I had no idea. Very cool. Well, the second voice that you just heard was Mr. Mike Cole.
Hi, yeah. I'm the author of the Military Fantasy Shadow Ops series. Military fantasy, not military science fiction. And it's Control Point, Fortress Frontier, and Breach Zone just came out in January. And I am in the military. I'm a lieutenant in charge of the reserve at U.S. Coast Guard Station, New York. We do all of the search and rescue and law enforcement around the island of Manhattan. I've been to Iraq 3 times, and I've done a lot of natural disaster response, including Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy, and also this was not natural, but the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
Mike, I don't know how old you are, and I'm not. I'm not going to ask.
Well, I don't mind. I don't mind telling people.
But okay, I'm curious. The first Gulf War.
Yeah.
Were you there?
No. I was there in the most recent engagement, the one we just officially ended again. Okay.
No, the reason I'm asking, I graduated high school with guys who went from high school into the military, and then the first Iraq War happened. And so the guys that I knew actually went to that first Iraq War. Now, they did come back, though, which is awesome. But yeah. Guys that I went to school with went there. So I was just curious if maybe they had crossed paths with you.
See, 9/11 changed a lot of people's lives. I was one of that generation who was going in one direction. I was on track to be a mild-mannered IT guy. And 9/11 happened, and I veered off and became a spy and then a counterterrorism operator, and then who I am now. So law enforcement eventually. Excuse me, when I say operator, I don't mean hard operator. I was never a door kicker, but 9/11 just threw me off path.
Sure, I understand. Yep, I remember. I think that's for a certain generation. It's like every generation has that moment that they remember. You know, yeah. My mom remembers when Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah.
I definitely remember two things, Challenger and 9/11. Mm-hmm. So, yes, definitely changed a lot of people's lives. Next up, Karen Lawachi.
Hi, I'm Karen. I teach. I'm the one on the panel here with no military background at all. But I did do what Jema alluded to, is that when I wrote my first series, I basically read a lot of memoirs. I read a lot of history books, but I read a lot of memoirs because for years I was just interested in the experience of war from the people who had experienced it. So from Vietnam to World War II, airmen, soldiers, everybody, I basically just read what I can get my hands on from like letters and things written from the people who were there. And that's a lot of what influenced me in my writing and kind of taking the point of view from children in war, which is basically was the focus of my series mostly and less on the experienced soldiers and more on the people who are kind of caught up in the tide of it. So that's my shtick.
Okay. Now, I don't know, when you talk about just talking to a soldier, I've found that it's very handy to live near Colorado Springs, Colorado, and go to writing groups and writing events and meetings in Colorado Springs, where all the Air Force and military people tend to be in the writers groups.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of, like, access. Like, I was lucky that I actually ended up meeting a friend of mine who's a friend of mine right now, but he read some of my stuff on a workshop, and we didn't know each other, and I didn't realize he was in the military and he didn't know anything about me. So he was reading my first novel as he was going, and he told me later, you know, when we first met, that he thought I'd served and all this kinds of stuff. And so ever since then, like we kind of kept in touch, and then I was kind of brazenly used him as one of my readers. Every time I would be asking him, you know, is this realistic and that kind of stuff. And so he helped me along the way with my subsequent novels. So, but before I met him, I didn't have any access to, I was also quite young. So I didn't young and callow. So I didn't really, you know to try and approach anybody, in the military to ask for research purposes. So I kind of just did it on my own, and then subsequently then got a little bit more familiar with it.
Can I clarify a point of terminology really quickly?
Sure.
This is something that's frustrating, is that the term soldier tends to be applied universally. At least in the United States military, soldier only applies to members of the United States Army. Marines are referred to as Marines. Members of the Navy are referred to as sailors. Members of the Air Force are referred to as airmen. And the Coast Guard is a little more nebulous. Sometimes we're called guardians. Sometimes we're called citizen sailors. Sometimes we're called Coast Guards. Or coasties, which is sort of the diminutive that we all accept. But I always like it when we use that point of clarity. So when you're speaking about, and not to be pedantic, just as long as we're on the topic.
And what are you called if you're in the Navy?
Sailor.
Oh, sailor. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. What? Who was laughing? Jane was laughing. So is there anything worse than having a non-military author write something and then have a military person come up and say, wow, this was horrible and wrong?
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because I would think that the military person, the person who has served, you know, you got inside knowledge, you're going to get it right. But if the non-military writer writes something and they just go off the deep end and they don't get it right, and it's so glaringly wrong to the military person.
Can I just set the tone here? I often get looked to, because I'm a member of the military, as sort of, you know, a voice of authenticity. And I really reject that assertion. I just feel like the military experience is a universal experience, and being a member does not grant you ownership of that experience. A perceiver, you know, a person living with a military, alongside a military, or watching a military on the news, is having a military experience. And I have no more authority than someone else does. It's just a different perspective on the same thing.
Well, that's not necessarily what I mean, Mike.
Oh, sure.
So if you have a story where you have a chef cooking and they're not even using knives and they're not using anything, and a chef reads that and goes, oh, wow, this is just horrible and wrong. That's what I'm talking about.
I think like anything else that you do when you write is you have to do your due diligence in the research. I mean, if you write something historical, say you're writing about samurais, I mean, you kind of have to do your due diligence. So I would assume that it would be the same with the military. And so people... I mean, I get emails and stuff from people who served all over and from different divisions and different branches and different militaries from different countries too. And I always kind of a little bit trepidatious when I read what they say. And I think I had the only time I've ever had anyone kind of take me to task was a girl who served in the Israeli military. And I guess some of the, and it's not even the technicalities of things, but some of the dynamics that I portrayed was in her experience. And so she took me to task for that. And I thought, okay, well, that's fine. but you do your best with anything. I mean, if the readers don't understand that the authors are trying to do their best with it, or assuming that the authors are doing their best with it, no matter what it is, whether it's any kind of subculture, whether it's the military, whether it's like writing about the mafia, whether it's, you know, writing about cops, you kind of have to do your due diligence and hope and really try and get it right. And if you don't please everybody, well, what are you going to do?
Okay.
And getting it right is such a nebulous term.
Yes. I mean, yeah.
You can go to 10 experts with a question,
yes,
and you will get 11 different answers sometimes.
Yeah.
And I've seen, you know, debates on message boards about a detail in a book or a game where somebody will say, I served, and this is completely wrong, and the next guy in the common thread will say, I served, and that's exactly what happened to me, and they're off and running. So the best you can do is do your research, get as much information as you can, and try and distill it down to what seems to be the consensus.
Whoa, hold on, I'm blown away. So you're saying that people disagree on the internet?
I know, it's shocking. But it happens sometimes.
Hey, can I just point out something? I'm Mr. Military, right? A lot of the action in Breach Zone takes place on a 225 seagoing buoy tender. It's a Coast Guard cutter. Keep in mind, I'm in the Coast Guard, but I'm in the small boat community where we do law enforcement and search and rescue. Those big cutters, they're Aton, aids to navigation. They have big cranes on their decks for lifting buoys out of the water. I don't know anything about them. I was on the internet researching those cranes for my novel, and I'm in the Coast Guard. So I just feel like, you know, being in the military or even having been in a war, I'm in the exact same position as Richard and Karen. The military is so vast and so diverse that you have to do your due diligence and you have to do your research.
You can also tell, too, when someone is trying to do a good job, and when they've just basically taken every single thing that they could possibly get and thrown it over their shoulders or not even bothered to do the research. Like I said, my cousin writes for Ranger Up, and so we've had some conversations about the portrayal of the military in Hollywood and such, and it's like, you know, there are times when a movie has a lot of military guys doing pretty heavy duty consulting for them, and they just go, nah, it gets in the way of the story, and end up doing something really obnoxious and inaccurate, intentionally. And when you have an author who's done the research and is trying to do right, I think that shows in the writing and makes a huge difference in how it's perceived than someone who goes, well, that doesn't make a good story, so I'm just going to, you know, screw that.
Let me pump up Rich here with another example. So I give an example of me being in the military having to do research. So if you look at Ghost Recon, one of the things when you sight in to target an enemy, the game captured the breathing. It captured how the breathing moves your sight picture.
Yes,
and you have to fire between breaths.
Yes,
that is one of the most authentic things I can possibly communicate to you. That is a fundamental of tactical marksmanship that I train in all the time. And that was done by a guy who's not in the military. So I just feel like, again, I'm hammering the same point over and over again, but that's a perfect example from one of our other guests.
Well, and I loved that you could just be the sniper and you could leave your guys in one spot and then just go off as the sniper and pick everybody off.
Yeah, I mean, it's And the other thing, in the shoot and move aspect of it, that when you fire your weapon, you're not going to take another shot from the same position.
Right.
You have to take another one because you've just indicated where the heck you are, which is bad news for if you want to stay alive. So, again, a very, very authentic notion from people who are not military members.
Very cool.
But we're an hour or so from Bragg, and there's a lot of folks on the team who have served, or family members that have served, who have friends that have served. So we've always tried to be very respectful and make sure we got the experience as authentic and accurate as possible while still staying within the bounds of what would be a fun game. Yeah. And so there's a lot of time and effort that goes into getting everything absolutely right, as well as you can within the space of a game. There's always that balance between what's authentic and what's believable within a game space. And sometimes what really happens, you know, you do your research, you find out how something went or how a procedure goes, and you realize that, you know, okay, sitting there waiting for the shot for 3 hours might not make the most exciting gameplay. So you fudge it a little bit there, but one of the hallmarks of the Tom Clancy brand, and that goes across all the sub-franchises, has been to try and be as respectful of the source material as possible.
Very cool. Now, Jame, we kind of jumped in with both feet here. Did you have a certain direction you wanted to go tonight?
This is, like I said, I have the questions as a suggestion if we're starting to wander. But one of the things that I did want to kind of start out with is the portrayal of the military in popular media. You know, you've got one of the most highly popular movies recently with one of the worst military portrayals, Avatar. Beautiful, beautiful movie. I don't know of a single military person who didn't just want to throw things at the screen from that. You know, Mike might have a different opinion, but I mean, even for me, and my boyfriend goes on many, many rants about Avatar, so that's the first thing that springs to mind. But what is it like as, you know, as an author who's done the research or as someone who's been in the military? You know, what is it like to see that? And what are a few representations, either in movies, in games, we've already mentioned a little bit, or in books where it's actually accurate to the to what is actually happening?
Okay, and the guys have been talking for a little bit. Let's let Karen start this one off. Karen?
I saw Lone Survivor recently, and I loved it. I mean, I'm not intimately familiar with Navy SEALs, but I really like that, and I'm one of my other favorite ones is Black Hawk Down. And again, I don't know my friend again who's in the military. That's one of his favorite films as well. He wasn't too keen on Hurt Locker, but I mean, Avatar is, I don't know, it's James Cameron. It's science fiction. They were a mercenary group. I don't know if they were supposed to be straight military in that way. I can't remember, but. Anyway, I love Lone Survivor. I mean, I like to talk about the movies that maybe did it well, and maybe Mike would have a better idea than me, but I really like that movie. I thought it was really intense. I'm drawing a blank on any of the others that have been out recently.
Okay.
Military films, but...
Well, before I let Mike go, Richard, what do you think?
I think, first of all, we have to bear in mind that every profession gets portrayed ridiculously by popular entertainment. I wish you the joy of watching an episode of House next to a doctor or an episode of Castle next to a cop, because good God, your ears are going to get blistered.
But they're not even trying, I don't think. I mean, they're not, you know, like, I don't know that those shows are really trying to be super, that's not their thing, to trying to be super realistic. So,
Every genre you're working in, you have the access from the super detailed and absolutely stone cold accurate to the, okay, we're going to call this person a soldier or a doctor or a lawyer or a ukulele repairman, and that's just an excuse for them to be hunted down by Liam Neeson at some point. that being said, I absolutely love T.C. McCarthy's trilogy.
Yes.
Those books, oh my God, they just absolutely blew me away in terms of really doing that ground level experience and doing so in a way that seemed like it was both very, very personal, at the same time offered that ground level view into the larger conflict that was going on. And I just devoured that stuff.
Very cool. Now, Mike, I'm going to put you on the spot. Stargate SG-1.
You know, listen, this is the thing with Stargate SG-1 and James Cameron's Avatar is that, glaring military errors can throw me out of the story, but it's really not what I'm looking for in a story like that. And I'm more trying to get caught up with it. And I really enjoy Stargate SG-1, to be quite honest. I want to just back Karen's play. I also want to help out Rich with T.C. McCarthy, in that his books are, the first one's called Germline, for your listeners so they can find them. Mm-hmm. And the most recent one's called Chimera. I don't remember what the middle volume is called.
Exogene,
thank you. Yeah. And that's, so just so if readers would like to find them. But yeah, so I wanna back Karen's movie choices for the same reason and add to it Zero Dark Thirty. Two things I wanna say about Zero Dark Thirty. One thing about Lone Survivor. They really, really nailed it, except for the very, very end, which you can tell when the Hollywood execs intervene.
Yeah.
But I've worked extensively with SOF operators, and there's some real notions that they got exactly right. So, for example, SOF operators aren't bound to uniform standards. So the first thing they do when they get in theater is they get rid of all their issue gear, and they bring their own stuff. So they buy Merrells, or a lot of the guys I work with bought Merrells. They got rid of the Belvoir boots they were issued, and they all used Mechanics gloves, Mechanics with an X, We use these two in the Coast Guard. I use them because they allow me to feel the intermediate double action trigger reset when I'm pulling a trigger because of the very, very thin fabric, the kind of fabric they're made of. And they have impact armor on the knuckles in case I got to, you know, do stuff with my knuckles. Anyway, the soft operators I use with get rid of their issue gloves and buy these or bring their own. And they tend to be used by guys in motocross. And they, if you look at Lone Survivor, you'll see them wearing these things. So they really, they paid some attention to the details in those. But I want to add Zero Dark 30, a couple of things about that. The first is the SEALs, the SEAL team going in to get Bin Laden at the end. A couple of things I want to point out is...
Spoiler!
Yeah. Bin Laden, oh, yeah, Bin Laden dies. Hey, as long as I'm on here, at the end of Titanic, the ship sinks. So anyway, the SEAL team that goes in... Yeah, sorry.
Where's Clive Cussler when you need him?
The SEAL team that goes in to get Bin Laden, they're moving in a very unhurried clip. And that's really important. They're concerned with staying on target, with having a stable firing platform, with keeping the bubble and not getting panicked and not getting rushed and keeping their fine motor control. And that is just SEAL all told. And you see that in Lone Survivor 2. The other thing is at the very end of Zero Dark 30, and I lost my shit when I saw this. You will see a man helping the agency analyst identify Bin Laden's body, and they show his name tape, and it says McRaven, and it's Admiral McRaven, the head of U.S. Special Forces. That guy gave me a Joint Service Commendation Medal after my third tour. So seeing him represented in that film, like it, I can't even tell you what that experience was like. It was both convicting and validating into my toenails. It was amazing.
There's a show that was originated on the BBC and then Cinemax played it here. It was called Strike Back.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It stars the guy who's playing the dwarf king in the new Hobbit movies, Richard Armitage.
Yes.
And they open up, and it's based on a series of books by I guess like a former SAS guy, and so the first series is only like 6 episodes because it's a BBC thing, and then the guy gets the Hobbit movie, and then they went off in a completely different direction, got new people on the show. Anyway, that first 6 episodes is the Hobbit guy and the sheriff from The Walking Dead, who is British, which I did not know, and. They opened the whole series up with this scene where those two guys are in combat and they're in Iraq or Afghanistan or something, and they're trying to get someone who's been kidnapped out of this hotel, and they were working with the military advisors, and they had to go in, and like you're talking about, Mike, they had to walk a certain way, and they had to look around the corners a certain way, and they had to do all this stuff, and the two actors, those two guys. They said, how long would it take you to do this? And the military advisor said, well, you know, from here to here, it'd be 6.5 minutes. They wouldn't let the director take the cut unless they could do the entire thing in 6.5 minutes. Because they wanted it to be that realistic. They wanted that military SAS guy to nod at them and say, yep, that's the way we would have done it. And I think you don't always get that in Hollywood. Or in they don't really... You know, it's just like, oh, let's do this, let's do that. I'm surprised, and Mike and I have talked about this before, no one mentioned Act of Valor.
Oh, yeah, bleh.
You didn't like Act of Valor.
And well, look, this is my problem, is that real SEAL TTPs, this is tactics, techniques, and procedures. And I'm looking at this thinking, look, in Hollywood, MOPIC had to sign off on this thing. I mean, a Pentagon MOPIC had to sign off on this thing. But... what the heck? I mean, if those are real SEAL TTPs, why are they in a movie? You know, I don't want the bad guys to know. I'm sorry, that's a simplistic term. I actually have a little more complexity than that, but it's what we say. I don't want the bad guys to know when I come on a boarding how I'm going to turn a corner and get in a hatch. I don't want them to know how I'm going to port my weapon and get up on my sights, and because that's going to tell them how to kill me. So I don't understand what the heck Act of Valor was about. Can I add one more thing to this? Since the Bin Laden, since Geronimo, there has been a rash of SEAL-related
yes.
tell-alls and books and No Easy Day. And let me just say something. The SOF community, Special Operations community, and the JSOC community especially, is a silent service like the Spy Corps. And look, I have a lot of frustration with overclassification and secrecy in the surveillance state, just like anyone else. But the Spec Ops community is not a community that writes books and makes movies and draws attention to itself. And these are what the operators and their commanders and support staff agree to when they take the oath and when they get in those units. And films like Act of Valor, in my opinion, are at odds with the essence of those communities. And so I feel a cognitive dissonance when I come into contact with those things.
Now I have a question for the group. And Jane, do you mind?
Patrick, just before you go there, sure. I think Mike will appreciate this a lot. My boyfriend is a retired Army Ranger, so every time a new SEAL anything comes out, I'm treated to about an hour worth of ranting on exactly that subject. And so one of our close friends, I actually just got attached to DevGru. And the first thing we did was load him up with hair gel and coupons for Oakley sunglasses. So yeah, it's not just you. There are a lot of people in that community who are kind of like, what is going on here? Why is this the new reality show?
Hey, full disclosure, the protagonist of my upcoming novel, Gemini Cell, is a Navy SEAL, but he's undead, so I figure that makes it okay.
There you go. So here's my question for the group, and Richard, I'm going to put you on the spot and have you answer first, because you've done the Clancy stuff, and there tends to be a little more sci-fi, I feel, in some of that stuff. So when you add the sci-fi to the military, does that free you up to do some different things, or do you feel like that pigeonholes you into something else completely?
Well, the mood that we've always gone for is the day after tomorrow, not the day after tomorrow, which is when you start getting to the really, you know, freaky stuff that DARPA's working on and whatever else. But the stuff that you look at and go, yeah, that could happen. Yeah, a couple years out, we could be seeing that. And that's really freeing in terms of giving players gameplay options. I mean, if you go back to the original Rainbow Six, the heartbeat sensor, that didn't exist at that time, but everybody believed it did because it seemed plausible and people were into it and it made for great functionality for the game. And so it fit seamlessly into that world, even though it was literally a piece of science fiction. And the thing to remember when you're making a game is that you're not only telling a story, you're also creating a gameplay experience, and the two have to meld seamlessly. So the story that you're telling has to support what the player is doing minute to minute, and what the player is doing minute to minute has to make sense within the world that you've built and the characters that you put in it and the boundaries that you've laid down for it.
Okay, gotcha. Karen?
What was the question again? Sorry.
When you add the sci-fi to the military sci-fi, does that open you up, or does it pigeonhole you?
I would think it, personally, I think it opens you up. Just the genre anyway, a science fiction kind of opens you up to possibility. I mean, that's in the definition of it for me. So, you know, you kind of try and predict. I mean, but it, like in the second, my second novel, I had like, I mentioned something about the, being able to, a way of hacking by putting these lenses in your eyes, and you can access, you know, an interface and do all of that. And then, you know, I had one of my readers the other day, you know, sent me the article about the technology where they actually have that, where it's a contact lens and then you can access the computers, and they were thought it was, you know, hilarious that 10 years later, you know, it's something that's actually, they're looking to market. And, but I mean, it's because at the time I, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I had read some like little thing in some scientific journal about this technology that they were working on to do. And I thought, well, surely then in my future, they would have it already. So I mean, I really like that kind of stuff gives me a buzz, kind of like, you know, what could be in the future, whether it's 10 years, 20 or 50, and then just trying to aim for it. I mean, obviously things are probably going to change in a way that we can't even predict, But it's fun. I consider it a lot of fun and freeing in a way that you're not necessarily bound by what's. I mean, we're living in an age of science fiction. I always think anyway. There's so much stuff that I guess maybe even the general public doesn't even know about that's being worked on.
And, no.
Yes, I know. Fascinating. So I think it's just a lot of fun to kind of try and excavate some of that.
Do you know, guys know Charlie Strauss has actually held off on novels that he has halfway written because the science fictional elements, and these are political and social elements, not technology elements, have come true. So he's like, I can't write this book right now. And he's shelved it.
That's funny. Now, Karen, when you do like the contacts and different things, do you look at what's out there right now? Do you try to extrapolate a little bit and see almost like being a futurist and kind of try to see where the technology is going?
I don't know. I mean, I guess a little bit, but I'm not a hard science fiction writer. I mean, I'm definitely more of a anthropological, psychological angled science fiction writer. So that's set dressing to me. And I mean, it's important in order to make the world realistic. But I mean, I know that I can't, you know, really predict super realistically the technologies because I'm not, that's not my, one thing, that's not my industry. And so I would have to, I mean, I do my research, but my angle with my books is more on a psychological level. And that stuff I do, but it's fun for me to try and, you know, kind of extrapolate. Like with the short story for the war, I mean, bringing it back to the anthology. I mean, I decided to write a story from the point of view of someone who actually wasn't in the military. But from their eyes, looking at what was going on with the loved one who was in the military, I mean, I was extrapolating what it would be like for someone fighting in space, and then, you know, biologically, what could be happening to them, technologically, what's could be integrated with them with a future soldier. And so that was something that was that tied into the whole psychological aspect to me. It's like, if you start altering people on a biological level in order to make them better at what they do, and in this case, as soldiers, then how does that affect people? And for that, I did, you know, I did do some reading about the different things. I actually went to a conference last year where the people were talking, doctors and stuff were talking about, you know, replicating organs and replicating parts of the body and where that can kind of lead, not just medically, but also militarily. And that kind of sparked me as part of the crux of the story of what that does to someone psychologically. So, yeah.
Okay, and before I go to you, Mike, I had one more question for Karen. And Karen, without any spoilers, did you or did you not like the last season of Sons of Anarchy?
The last one, season 6, that they just finished? Yes.
Yeah, you did.
I liked it a lot better in season 5.
Okay, even with it beginning with the kid and the thing and the other thing and then...
I don't remember what happened in the beginning of it, but I thought it ended really well.
Dave Navarro was dating the gal and her son.
Oh, that thing.
Yeah, that thing.
Well, it was good for Juice. It was a good story arc for Juice.
Okay. Okay. I was just curious. So, Mike, now the same question to you.
It's off topic.
the question to you about the sci-fi, and what I'm curious is, did you, Mike, look at the world today, the military landscape, the technology that they were using, and think to yourself, gosh, what these guys need are dragons?
No, I just
dragons
feel like
make everything cooler.
They do. You're absolutely right on that. This is my thing with military science fiction. With the exception of Robert Buettner, Joe Haldeman, and Jack Campbell, I've generally seen military science fiction as coming out of the Bane books crowd of John Ringo and Eric Flint and David Weber and all those guys. And it's just not my bag, man. Like that whole oeuvre, that style, that scene is not something I really identify with. Listen, I'm not bashing these guys at all. They're talented writers with huge fan bases, and I should be so lucky to have that kind of fan group. But like the Larry Correas of the world, I often get sort of lumped in with them, and it's just not my tribe. So I'm a fantasy nerd. Like, I do like some science fiction. Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game is one of the books that changed my life, despite the author being a vile human being. The Leviathan Wake series, James S.A. Corey, is fabulous, and the authors I've just mentioned. But by and large, my reading diet and the things that influenced me the most has been fantasy. And when you look at my love of the military, I've spent my entire life living and working around the military, my love of fantasy, those two streams crossing, it almost seems inevitable that that these are the books I would wind up writing. But I do want to say that I have absolutely been pigeonholed as a writer of military fiction. And I feel those chains after only three books, and it bugs the hell out of me. And one of my big goals is to be a writer with a capital W. I love Jim Butcher, well, for lots of reasons. He's a great guy and a great writer. But look at Codex Alera alongside Dresden Files, and look at that diversity. Look at George R. R. Martin with, you know, Song of Ice and Fire, but also Armageddon Rag and Fever Dream. I mean, this is a guy with a palette, right? So one of the things I'm doing right now is not under contract, but completely on spec. I am now going through my second editorial pass, planning pass, at a dark, grimdark medieval fantasy along the lines of Mark Lawrence's Broken Empire with a 12, 13-year-old-ish a gay female protagonist, which I have high hopes for. And my agency is, at first they weren't going to work with it. Now they are going to work with it. And I'm really hopeful that I'm going to make it dynamite. I had a really good reaction to a small piece I read from the Baltimore Science Fiction Society. But I desperately, desperately and really strongly want to break out of the military ghetto. I love writing in it, and I always will. But yeah, I get frustrated when people refer to me as a military writer. Mm-hmm.
Now, James, you've mentioned a couple times your former Ranger boyfriend. Has he inspired you to write any military science fiction?
He actually was one of the people who really got me started a couple of years ago working more closely with some of the stuff before we started dating. And one of the things he said was that one of the very few authors that he'd read who really seemed to get the military in general was George R. R. Martin, because he'd read a lot of the Bane books, and he'd had issues with them. There was also the John Ringo quote at the military SF panel at Dragon Con last year, where all the units in Iraq had robots with guns mounted on them clearing the way, and I had made the mistake of taking two infantrymen into that panel with me, and I could just see the smoke clouds rising from them. But, yeah. You know, it's not so much that he's inspired me to start writing that sort of thing. I already had quite a bit of that in what I was writing, so much as he's gotten me into the nonfiction side of things and into more of, you know, working really hard to make sure that it's accurate. The disclosure that I'll make that's still not really public knowledge is I'm actually working on joining probably in January or so. One of the reasons I'm pushing so hard on all of my projects. I've been talking to recruiters and everything there. This is something I've wanted to do for years. So this has always been part of my mindset. I mean, this was when I was a teenager. I wanted to be infantry, and I found out I wanted to be special forces, and I found out that women weren't allowed to do that. And so when that changed recently, that kind of just made me realize how much I still wanted to do it. So yeah, there are very few people who know, but this is probably my last year in science fiction for a while at least. But
you just told a lot of people.
This is putting a huge smile on my face. I am so delighted to hear this. I mean, the military has been such a huge force for good, and I hope you'll consider the Coast Guard. And if you are going to go the officer route, I hope you'll let me write one of your letters. I'm so, so pleased to hear this.
I would love to have you write one of my letters. I'm actually, as a brief digression, one of my best friends is a coastie who's actually being sent to D.C. later this year. She runs the social media side of things, Anna Visneski. I don't know if you've run in CrossFire at all, but if not, I really should introduce you to.
Yeah, we're a small service. We all know each other, so if I'm sure our paths have crossed.
But yeah, I'm looking more at Army. What I would like to do would be to work in PsyOps with the Special Forces teams on that kind of stuff, because it would allow me to use what I already do in an element that would be challenging and really, really enjoyable for me. So, I would absolutely love to take you up on that offer of 11.
Yeah, please, you know how to find me. Hey, as long as we're talking about Ringo, he was guest of honor at, I don't remember the con, and I was moderating a panel that he was on, and he referred to some female soldiers as guys with breasts, except he didn't use the word breasts. And I think that was one of the signal moments when I realized that scene, again, mostly coming out of Bane, was just not, I wasn't real thrilled with that remark. And I just realized that, you know, this is not a scene that I want to participate in.
And, you know, that's actually that's one of the huge impacts, or one of the huge reasons that we decided to do war stories, is that it really does seem kind of like there's a pretty heavy weight of the Vietnam era, you know, still on it. Like, there's not even much set in the first Gulf. And I really wanted to reboot it and kind of show that it does have a future and it is moving forward. And I am so happy with some of the stories we have. I got Karen Lord on the next panel because, you know, I emailed her and she's like, oh, I don't write really military science fiction. It's like you write about the social and political and cultural elements surrounding it. And that is part of military science fiction anymore, because war is cyber, it's psychological, it's all of these different things. It's not just point and shoot anymore. And I really do feel like some of the authors have forgotten that or never realized it.
And I don't know if you know, but Karen Lord was a cadet in the Bahamian,
yes,
or Barbados officer academy. There are also other military authors in science fiction and fantasy that people don't know about. For example, Tanya Huff was in the Canadian Navy. Elizabeth Moon was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps.
Whoa. You're not going to convince me that Canada has a Navy.
Yeah, then we'll certainly do. But yeah, I mean, like Elizabeth Moon was a Marine Corps lieutenant. These are both women writing in science fiction and fantasy that have military backgrounds that our attention is not always drawn to. And I do want to call them out for the purposes of your listeners.
Very cool.
Yeah, there's actually a really strong female science fiction military contingent that I'm really hoping people start seeing.
Well, and we've been running now for about 50 minutes. Why don't we talk a little bit more about this anthology, Jane?
So T.C. McCarthy was mentioned earlier. He has a story in it that is very grim, very fascinating. There are a couple of people on this panel who apparently have stories in there. One of whom still needs a contract from me. I was working on that, Rich, I promise.
Mm-hmm. Just remember, he can actually add you to a game and have you killed.
My boyfriend is a contractor for UB. I don't think he'll do that. It would end badly for everyone, especially me.
say nothing.
But what I'm really excited about with the anthology is that we have one of the most diverse sets of stories that I think I could have hoped for. We have everything from the traditional power suits, but with some questions about the morality and you know, things surrounding that, to Karen's absolutely beautiful story that's a romance in many, many ways. But it's all, you know, from my reading of it, I saw it as a romance with space and with war as much as between two people and the effect of, you know, the people left behind, which is something I personally know how it feels. And now I'm seeing how it feels for someone else as I'm starting to have those talks. But it's just a beautiful collection of stories that I'm really proud of. Some of them I feel are possibly going to happen very soon. There's one in particular that is very frightening in many ways that it could happen, you know, in the next 10 years. And it's a very grim, almost Fahrenheit 4 or 5, Ray Bradbury sort of future that is not fun to contemplate. And I like that we have that range of stories in there. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Very cool. And when is the anthology coming out?
We just sent the rough draft to the publisher today. So I'm going to say probably in the next 2 months. So giving myself space for more catastrophes of an unnamed sort that I'm going to say June probably.
Okay.
That's when we told our backers. So
awesome. And for the benefit of Richard, I'm going to say that normally what I do at this point, Richard, is I let people on the podcast just have a final thought. And so I'm going to go around and let everybody, you know, kind of sum up their thoughts. And don't forget to tell people about your websites and your social media. So let's start with Karen. Karen, any final thoughts?
I just want to thank Jane for saying those nice things about my story. And I'm really enthusiastic for the anthology, basically, because of what you said. When the premise was pitched to me, I thought it was really timely. And definitely a book I would want to read anyway, regardless of whether I got a story in it or not. And I guess, well, you can find me on Twitter at Karen Lowe, and that's Karen with an I.
And you should talk to her about Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, I already watched Sons of Anarchy.
I just like to tease her.
No, that was filmed in my neck of the woods. That's the area I grew up. I'm familiar with that area.
Oh, really?
It takes place in Oakland, but they shoot it in LA.
Well, yeah, the towns that it takes place in are around where I grew up, and that culture is very familiar. If you go to my hometown, it looks like you're on a Sons of Anarchy set. I am not even kidding.
Well, I just love it for its Shakespearean overtones.
Yes.
What's funny is I love when they film where they're supposed to be where I grew up in Fresno. It's like, yeah, we're in Fresno. And you're looking at it and you're going, that's not
no,
Fresno.
You're not.
That's LA. Come on.
And to tie it in, you know, a couple of those guys are supposed to be ex-military, so.
Interesting.
To be fair, no, I'm sorry, Patrick, but no one wants to be in Fresno any more than they can help.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what, a 15% unemployment rate at this point? Who knows?
Is that all?
It's pretty bad. Final thoughts, Mike?
For folks that are interested in the military, I really hope that you'll take James' example. And if going active duty is not for you, I hope that if you meet qualifications, you'll consider a reserve commitment. The military is part of the citizenry of this country. We are you and you are us. And if you don't meet the requirements to be even a reservist, we do have auxiliaries for all five branches. Which have, you know, there's a Civil Air Patrol. The Coast Guard Auxiliary is very, very important and instrumental in our mission. So there really is, there are ways to get involved. And if you've admired the military, I really encourage people to be participatory. It's hard, at times it's frustrating, but it really is a major, major force for good. And please feel free to contact me if you feel I can help talk you into it. And you can find me at my website, www.mikecole.com, MYKECOLE.com, on Twitter at Mike Cole. Again, that's Mike with a Y, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Mike Cole.
And final thoughts, Richard.
I think one of the great things about the anthology, as Jay mentioned, is that it shows the breadth of the sort of material that you can get under military science fiction. You know, like we've been discussing, it's very easy to pigeonhole it just as boom, 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 charging, kick the door down and have that sort of very narrow sort of adventure almost definition to it. And the fact that a book like this can come along and make people think about just the breadth of material that can come under the rubric of military science fiction, I think is going to be a breath of fresh air and hopefully lead to a lot more, you know, interesting books set in that broader genre as we go forward.
Website?
RichardDansky.com.
And what do you got planned coming down the pipe for Xbox One and PlayStation 4?
I am not at liberty to say.
Damn! It was worth a shot. I am curious. Do you know, and you don't have to answer this if you can't answer it, but I'm curious, are developers still going to push out stuff for PS3 and Xbox, or are they just going to concentrate on Xbox One and PS4?
Something to bear in mind is that there is a huge install base of the PS3, of the Xbox 360, even so of the Wii. I mean, the PS2 and the regular Xbox were still selling games for 5+ years after the next generations of consoles came out. And, you know, as long as there are people who are still playing games in those boxes, companies are still going to be making games on those boxes.
Very diplomatic answer.
I do my best.
Yes. I was a little bit cheesed off because I saw that the next Batman game is coming out on Xbox One and PS4, but not Xbox 360. And I was like, no!
Well, software has traditionally driven hardware.
Yes. Jame, final thoughts?
So I just kind of want to go off of what Mike was saying with the, even if you are not, if you don't have time in your schedule, if you don't have the interest in being involved with the military, it's worth spending some time getting to know the culture that that veterans deal with and some of the issues that they're having to deal with coming back. One of the things that has been discussed a lot recently is that we have a high survivability rate due to modern medicine and modern weapons, protective gear, all of that. That also means that we have a huge percentage of veterans who are dealing with issues, physical, emotional, that they're expected to come back from the military and immediately transition into civilian life. And that is a very, very difficult transition for a lot of people. There are a lot of organizations that either help the veterans or profess to help them or to help their families. Some of the really good ones that I suggest checking out, the number one is Team Rubicon. It's actually a group made up entirely of former veterans, and they're a volunteer group that helps with disaster recovery. So they've been all over the world. I think they've done well over 50 missions at this point. And it's wonderful because it gives returning vets a sense of purpose, a sense of helping, and being that responsible party that they've been for so long. It also helps people who have been stricken by hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, fires, you know, even the recent ice storm. So they're a great company that could use a lot of support and a lot of love, and there are some other really great sites out there too. And if you're just wanting to get to know more about the culture of the military, a really good place to start is the Ranger Up blog, Rhino Den. It's run by former vets, and a lot of the writers there are still current or contractors. So there are a lot of good stories there, and they don't pull the punches. It can be a little to the conservative side politically, but it's a really good thing to look at.
And I'll throw one more thing out there. You guys are talking about all kinds of different things. Number one, if you're on the fence and you're thinking about it, but you're not sure and this and that, I think I've told Mike this story before. I had about 4 or 5 really, really good friends growing up, and 3 of them went into the military right out of high school. One guy wanted to and didn't. You know, he kind of stayed with his mom, and who was her. His dad had died, and so he was needed at home, and so he kind of stayed. And just about 3 or 4 years ago, he was right on the edge of eligibility age-wise, and he just said, "I've always wanted to do this," and he signed up, and he's serving today. So you can, if you want to. You know, all you have to do is just make that leap. And the other thing I want people to remember is, at least in this country, in the United States, our army, our military is volunteer. So these are folks who chose that life and chose to serve. And so, you know, be kind to them and thank them when you see them. That's what I got to say. Anyway, thanks to everybody who came on the podcast tonight. Appreciate it. Definitely go check out the anthology. Jame, do you guys have a website for that?
We do. It's warstoriesanthology.com. Also, I apologize. My dogs are protecting me vigorously and vocally in the background.
That's okay.
From God knows what. So if there's bellowing, it's the 2 hellhounds downstairs. Not me, I promise. I'm not actually killing anyone over here now. So, but the easiest way to find it is if you're on Facebook, we have a page on there, War Stories Anthology, that we update frequently, and we're at War Stories Antho on Twitter, and we should have the full table of contents and the finalized cover posted there soon.
Very cool. And Richard, anywhere we can go to get betas of any games?
Talk to me offline. I know a guy who knows a guy.
Rich, you should tell them what your Twitter is. I'm sure that people would enjoy it immensely.
Even without finding Bigfoot on every Sunday night to fill up the content? Or?
You weren't supposed to tell them why they would find it immensely entertaining. I wanted them to find out themselves.
That's because you're a bad person.
Yes.
As a Twitter feed is at Ardansky.
All right. Very cool. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal Irregulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.